program vector, sorry, parameter is insane. A movie, it looks like in a cinema. It's really cool. So thank you. Hi, my name is Mario Gren. I'm a group leader at Max Planck Institute for the Science of Light in Erlangen in Germany. And one of the goals of my group is to use AI as a source of inspiration for new ideas in physics. And in my talk, I will first show this on two concrete examples. One of them is AI-based design of quantum experiments, and the other one is prediction and suggestions of new research directions. And afterwards, I will look at it at a bigger picture. Okay, so my background is in experimental quantum optics. I worked in the lab of Anton Zeilinger, and there we tried to explore unobserved entanglement structure, unobserved new entanglement structures, such as this high-dimensional three-particle entangled GZ state. And usually when we want to create a state like this, we sit down and we think about it with a piece of paper and maybe on a blackboard. And usually we find a suitable solution how to build such a state in the lab rather quickly. However, in this example, in this case, it was different. Several of my colleagues and we tried for weeks to try to find a suitable experimental blueprint, blueprint that we can build in the laboratory. But we failed for weeks, and we couldn't find any way how to implement such a state in the laboratory. And I found this is very weird, and I thought maybe we should think about it in a different way. And at that time, I thought maybe one can actually automate the design process for quantum experiments. And with this thought in mind, I wrote a small little program. So the idea of this algorithm is that we start with an experimental toolbox, and this toolbox has in it all of the experimental components that we have in our laboratory, like beam splitters, phase shifter, and so on. So the first thing the computer is doing initially is it assembles the elements from the toolbox in a random way to build up a random experiment. And then it computes its properties. And if it doesn't find a solution, it goes back and tries again. But if it finds the solution, it reports it. It simplifies the solution and reports it to the user. And not only that, it takes this simplified solution and puts the simplified solution already in its own toolbox. And in that way, the algorithm learns useful subsystems that are useful to build up quantum experiments and in its next iterations. And this significantly speeds up the discovery process for more complex systems. So I applied this little algorithm to our high-dimensional GZ state, and within just a few hours, we actually discovered the experimental blueprint that we as human scientists were not able to find for weeks. And this solution was actually very practical and feasible. And then in a multi-year project, several of my colleagues were able to build this experiment for the first time and observe for the first time genuine high-dimensional multiparticle entanglement in a laboratory. So at that time, we were, of course, very happy with this algorithm, and we applied it to many other systems and to questions that we were not able to solve by ourselves. And this has led the number of new results, for instance, new ways to control single photons on, or even the first high-dimensional quantum teleportation, the setups have been created with this algorithm. And very recently, we applied basically the same algorithm to superconducting quantum computers, so to the quantum computer of IBM. So there, we also wanted to create high-dimensional multiparticle entanglement, something that has not been shown for these machines yet. So for that, we had access to a local three-dimensional space, which consists of the ground state and the first two excited states. So we were, at this point, we had the question, how does the circuit look like? And we were, again, not able to find this answer by hand. And basically with the same algorithm as before, I ran it, and in a few minutes, it was able to give the correct circuit that we were then able to run on the IBM machines, and that have led to the first observation of high-dimensional multiparticle entanglement also in a superconducting quantum system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first thing is we have the toolbox, okay, and there's everything that we have available experimentally. And then in the first step, the computer, because it doesn't have any knowledge, it tries to resample those tools randomly. So it has a virtual table and puts those devices on a virtual table, and then just computes what is the outcome if I would produce such a thing. So there are lasers and devices that create single photons and so on, and it would just look what is the final outcome of the experiment. And if it if it doesn't fit to what the user wants, it rejects it and tries new. So one trick that one can do there is to break down the complexity of the question into many, many sub-questions. And when it solves a sub-question, it puts the solution of the sub-question into the toolbox, and then it has already more clever sub-devices in the toolbox. So it kind of bootstraps the knowledge of experimental quantum optics in the toolbox and has larger and larger systems in the toolbox. And at some point, it can use those systems to build actually the final big question, which was the high-dimensional geodz state. Yes. Yeah, that is exactly how we use this algorithm. Yeah. Thanks for the question. I should have mentioned this bootstrapping. Uh-huh.
Just a small second picture in mind. Conducting example using circuits for blueprints. What exactly does the blueprint look like? Like how to set up your lab?
So the solution for the superconducting system is here. And for quantum optics, it looks actually very similar. You don't have individual qubits, but you have photons or powerful photons that can have correlated photons. So it would look exactly the same. And what I get out is just basically a picture like this. And this picture describes then what my colleagues should do in the lab. Just you need to be very careful in the lab to set everything up, so you cannot just put it there. It took 4 years to build from the time when we had the setup as a blueprint to observing those first time discorrelations. It took 4 years.
Actually a picture.
Yeah, it looks like a picture like this. Yeah. Okay. So this worked very well, but for me, the most interesting thing was that you can actually learn new things from this algorithm. And I want to show this on one concrete example. So after I was searching for these high-dimensional GZ states in photonics, I let the algorithm run for a couple of weeks on some unused computers and search for more general high-dimensional multiparticle systems. And I gave the algorithm a certain resource, a limited resource. And with this limited resource, I know that the algorithm cannot go beyond some certain entanglement dimensionality. So then I let it run over a few weeks, and after I came back, I saw that the algorithm actually found a solution that is way beyond of the limitation that I thought needs to be there because of the limited resources. So I was extremely curious and confused why it is able to overcome this limitation. because it shouldn't, from all of my understanding. So I was analyzing then the solution of the computer. There's many papers of printouts. I was sitting there for days and trying to see what the algorithm was doing. And then I saw that there is something that the computer invented implicitly, a new technique that I was able to understand. And as soon as I was able to understand this, I was able to generalize this idea what the computer used to many other quantum systems, or to many other, at least photonic quantum systems. And so we were very happy, and we wrote a paper about this, and we were happy to publish it in BRL. And now if you think about this BRL paper, the conceptual contribution of this BRL paper did not come from any of the co-authors, but it came from the computer who completely implicitly invented this new technique. Our job was just to kind of understand what the computer was doing. So sometimes I get asked whether we put the computer as a co-author. Unfortunately, at the time, we didn't think about this. We wrote it in the acknowledgments. But a few years later, Anton and I were invited to participate in a paper about big questions, big future questions in science. And there we were able to smuggle in our AI algorithm into the author list. So my algorithm was called Melvin, and we smuggled in art.i.melvin. So now my algorithm is part of a peer-reviewed paper. But the cool thing is what happened after. Namely, two of the co-authors became or won a Nobel Prize after that. So John Goodenough for battery research in chemistry, and Anton Zeilinger very recently. So now we have a computer algorithm which co-authors a paper with two Nobel laureates. And I think that is quite unique. Okay, so then over the next few years, we tried to invent new computer algorithms that that work more efficiently in the design of new quantum experiments. So we and others have explored then genetic algorithms, reinforcement learning algorithms, deep generative models, for instance, variational autoencoders, and so on. But what was by far most efficient was a change of perspective, namely a change of the representation. And this is what we introduced in this article. Here we changed the question of designing quantum experiments to a question in graph theory. So we were able to find a link between graph theory and quantum optics. So we can translate the question here. The AI then solves the question in graph theory, and we can then take the solution back and translate it to quantum optics. And just very briefly, here the vertices stand for, you can think about it as the paths of photons, then the edges stand for correlations between photons, the weights are, the weight of this graph is basically the strength of those correlations, and the color stands for something like the internal mode. If it's a qubit, it's 0 or 1, or if it's a Q-tree, it's 0, 1, and 2. And the cool thing is, and that's the most important thing, that everything we can do here in the laboratory, we can describe with a finite colored-weighted graph. And each of those colored-weighted graphs, we can translate back to quantum optics. Yeah, and this algorithm, because it's so much simpler to work in the graph picture just of correlations, this algorithm is orders of magnitude faster than the algorithm I explained before, or than reinforcement learning or deep generative models. So this is basically, to the best of our knowledge, the fastest algorithm so far for these questions. And over the last couple of months, we have enormously expanded or tried to expand this graph experiment link and wrote a much more powerful algorithm that we called PyTorus. And we applied PyTorus to 100 different new quantum experiments. So its goal was to discover actually new 100 new solutions for 100 questions. And those questions are in the domain of quantum state generation, quantum transformation, quantum simulation, quantum gates, and even quantum communication protocol discovery. And so if you're interested, the tool is written in Python. It's very user-friendly. It has more than 100 examples at the GitHub website, and you can just install it with pip install PyTorch Q. So we tried then to understand the solutions that the computer found. And actually, my students were able to extract why many of those solutions worked. So it seems, and that's what they have uncovered, that most of those solutions use a certain structure, experimental structure that has a very specific experimental property or outcome. And this seems to be the key resource for many of those solutions. And the interesting thing is, we looked then back into the history and we saw that some rudimentary implementation of this new resource have already been used in some historic experiments, for instance, the first quantum teleportation experiment. So, so while we understood now many of those solutions, of those 100 solutions, several others are very weird and highly surprising that they can even exist. So one example is in quantum communication protocol discovery. So now let me ask, who knows what entanglement swapping is? Oh, not so many, that's interesting. Okay, Roger? Yeah, okay, you had your hand, good. quantum entanglement swapping was just a few weeks ago mentioned at this year's Nobel Prize. And it's an idea of how you can entangle two particles that have never interacted with each other. And the idea is that you create a pair of entangled particles here, a pair of entangled particles here, and you send two of those particles to one station and make a Bell state measurement. So you project them into a Bell state. And by projecting those two particles into a Bell state, also those distant particles get projected into an entangled state. So by that, you can entangle those distant particles. And now, if you think about, I want to distribute now the entanglement of two particles, you would think now that you need to send two particles and project them into an entangled state. If you want to share three particle entanglement, you would think you need to share three particle entanglement and project them into entangled state. But what the algorithm has found is that just by measuring two pairs in the center, you can actually distribute three particle entanglement. But this is less than one entangled pair photon pair that you entangled in the distance, and that is very weird. And to the best of our knowledge, has never been discussed in the literature that should be possible. In the literature, it seemed that this bound, this implicit bound of one Bell pair measurement leads to one entanglement that is fixed to that was how the literature, it's described in the literature. But it seems that is not what is necessary. So, and we are trying to understand this right now. And if you have ideas or are interested, please let me know. So here it is then very clear that our algorithm, PyTorch, can actually lead to surprising new ideas or let us look into new directions that we wouldn't have looked at otherwise. Okay, now let me change the topic. So let's take a step back and look at the question or look at our goal that we want to make a computer program that can inspire new and surprising ideas. So for that, of course, we need to know what does it mean that something is surprising or interesting. And this is very subjective and depends on our previous knowledge. So now the only question is, how can we get this previous knowledge into a computer that the computer can work with it. So and for that I use, for this I use ideas that came from computational sociology. And computational sociologists work together with biochemists and in a way developed a method how to generate a knowledge graph. And I used a very similar thing in quantum physics. And that's what I'm going to explain. So a semantic network is also called a knowledge network or knowledge graph. It captures, in a way, the knowledge of, in our case, of scientific publications. And what this is, or what this is doing is the vertices of this semantic network are concepts, in this case of quantum physics, and the edges are drawn when two concepts are studied together by scientists in a scientific paper. And here for quantum physics, the concept list I got using Wikipedia and quantum physics books and 100,000 papers from archive from the category QuantPH. There I applied natural language processing and extract a key concept. So this led to a list of roughly 6,000 concepts. These are now the vertices of my knowledge network. And the edges are drawn when two concepts are studied together. For instance, in this article, there is interaction-free measurement studied together with single photon Michelson interferometer. It's published in the year 1995. That means single photon interaction-free measurement Michelson interferometer each get a link with the timestamp 1995. And here, a few years later, Fabry-Perot with Michelson interferometer, so they get the link, or here Leggett-Garg with interaction-free measurement, this is here, get the link from 2015. So you get the point. You have this huge network that carries kind of the evolution of the past years. And actually for a paper source, I didn't only use these 100,000 papers from archive because they don't capture everything. They are only started in 1990 or 1992, and many are not put on archive. So I asked APS whether they can send me all of the paper that they have ever published. And surprisingly, they said yes and sent me a Dropbox link where I can just download all 650,000 papers that they have published. So that was very good. Now, I built up this semantic network using those 750,000 papers. And with this, create an evolution, basically the evolution of how quantum physics researched happened over the last 100 years. But now, of course, if you have the evolution of the past, if you know how this network behaved in the past, you can ask the question how it will behave in the future. So you can ask the question, what will happen in the future? And formulate it as a network theoretical task, you would ask, which two vertices that don't share a weight, don't share edge, will be connected in 5 years? Or translated to science, you can ask, which two concepts that scientists have never investigated before will be investigated in the next 5 years. So this is a link prediction task in AI, and the link prediction task is in this large semantic network. So this is a small picture of the semantic network, and we want to predict how the state of this network looks in the future. So how we train this, is by using a, or how we do this prediction task is by using a neural network, which we train with data from 2017, and we give it the properties of two unconnected vertices, and the network should predict whether it will be connected, yes or no, in 5 years, so in 2022. But for 2022, we of course have the data. So we know whether this link was drawn or not. So we can actually give a perfect supervision signal. So, and when we do this, we can then actually train in a supervised way this neural network. And when it is trained, we could then just put in the semantic network of 2022 into the neural network, and then predict what will happen in 2027. And so this could predict the future research direction of the whole scientific community or quantum community in a way. And the prediction quality is surprisingly high. And you could use this now not only for predicting what will happen, but you could use it for suggesting what you could work on. And I gave a talk in Roger's seminar roughly a year ago, and I predicted what his research will be in the next 3 or 5 years. And we should check this out, whether this has already worked out, my predictions. I have them here. I searched for them yesterday. Okay. So here you could think about making personalized predictions. But you can also think about this tool as a potential to initiate scientific collaborations. So think about you have a friend in cosmology, and you... Mm-hmm.
I mean, half a question, half a joke, perhaps. Are you picturing this more as an actual, you know, that people use? Or let me say it this way, because you're framing it as predicting rather than suggesting. Actually widespread.
Yeah.
And it becomes like a self-fulfilling prediction.
Right? Yes. This is, first I 100% think that this is what will be done in the future, and I'm actually trying this out right now on a little bit larger scale. I try to, it's recorded, I shouldn't mention it, but I try to connect around 12 different research groups and suggest what collaboration they could start. And I'm hoping to get, then you would have roughly 100 different combinations, and I'm hoping to get a lot of feedback from them. So I really think this will be useful. I've seen it for myself. I gave it once in a talk where the person then came to me, because I predicted it for this person, and said, okay, I have a grant application about exactly your first prediction, and so on. So. Yeah, but what you say is a very big problem that could be circumvented if you make suggestions personalized. Because then it's, then not everyone will work on the same thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So have you tried like previous year's data?
Yes. This is actually exactly how we evaluated the model. We used the data from 2012. We trained the neural network with the 2012 data, with feedback from 2017. And then we predicted from 2017, 2022. And we see the quality of those predictions. And I could go into this later a little bit more. For quantum physics, it was kind of good. I applied this then also in an AI competition last year to the research of AI itself, so kind of AI predicting the future of AI research. And we saw that there are some quasi-deterministic patterns. So you get the quality of the predictions were absurdly high. So it seems that science is not so random, but highly predictable from what happened in the past. I'm happy to go into this later.
I think it would be to see like which years on the which subfield that you do not predict well. Then you can kind of learn from that structure.
You mean which is not predicted high?
Yeah, the prediction is not correctly predict the future, then that also give you some kind of...
Yes. Those would be the highly unexpected solutions, yeah. How much time do I still have? Am I still in time? Again? Okay, yeah, then, that's good. Okay, so Now I told you about those two different directions. Let's take a step back and let's look at the question how AI in general could potentially contribute to scientific understanding. And to answer this question, we have asked roughly 100 computational chemists, physicists, and biologists and AI researchers about their personal stories, how they got new ideas with machines. And this, together with insights from philosophy of science, we were then able to kind of characterize those potential into three different classes. And one of those classes is AI as a source or resource of inspiration. And that's basically the last thing I would like to show, the different possibilities, what I think that AI could use as a, how we could use AI as a source of inspiration. So one is, of course, anomaly detection or potentially anomaly discovery. For instance, the algorithm, how I used it, that found this new entanglement structure that we then generalized and published in BRL, that was kind of an anomaly. It was a vast outlier in this whole space, and we were then able to look into this outlier and saw what it was doing. A different thing is using literature, scientific literature, and there are some very cool works in chemistry and material science where people make a word-to-vec encoding of 3 million scientific papers and then look into the latent space, and they see that materials are very closely clustered with their properties. And when they look into this latent space, they find actually some new materials that were not known to have some certain properties, just by looking at the global knowledge of 3 million papers. Okay. Other possibility is, of course, interpretable results, so using a neural network and trying to extract in an interpretable way what it is doing. One field is here is symbolic regression. That's a very hot topic. Other field is you could have other type of interpretable results. For instance, our graphs for quantum optics, we find it now much easier to interpret those compared to standard quantum optics. Different way is to look inside of the model and see what the model is actually doing. And there are some very interesting works about this where people found out, okay, to solve this certain question, the model has performed some coordinate transformation that people know is useful, but the model didn't know before. So that's also very interesting if you then apply it to future questions. And a different way would be to observe the behavior of a machine. And this is something that I've not seen applied in science yet, but that's absolutely cool. So I need to show this. I need 30 seconds for this. So here the idea is curiosity-based reward for reinforcement learning in video games. So usually how video games are solved is by applying some reinforcement learning agent, which has a reward that comes from the environment, which could be the points in the video game. And the agent just tries to maximize the change the strategy to maximize those points. But people found out that you could do it without those external rewards, just by creating internal rewards. And that works in that way, that the machine is motivated to go into directions of the search space, which it doesn't understand very well. So it can predict what happens after it makes some moves, and it can predict its uncertainty, and it goes into that direction where it is most uncertain, so where it doesn't know much about it. So in a way, it is curious about this new direction. It goes into those curious directions. And if you think about it, you could, if you have now a search space of quantum experiments or circuits, the machine would go into different regions, and maybe it gets stuck somewhere. And at this place where it gets stuck, maybe there is a new physical phenomenon that you need to predict what happens. So the machine, if you look at the behavior of the machine, it kind of tells you where you should look to see new phenomena. I'm pretty sure this works, but if you try it and it doesn't work, please don't blame me. Okay, so let me come to a quick conclusion. So in quantum optics, we have now algorithms which can solve open questions, give us actually new ideas that we can understand and learn and generalize from. And I also talked about the predictions of future research directions, and there are a lot of open questions. For instance, those that you mentioned, those the problem with self-fulfilling prophecies. But still, it is a very promising task, I think, to have a machine that can suggest you new directions. And in the very end, I want to ask what is actually, at the fundamental level, the difference between a human scientist and what an artificial scientist could be. So one could say, yeah, artificial scientist, a human scientist, a human is, of course, creative. But if you have looked at some output of OpenAI's DALL-E 2 recently, it's very difficult to say that they are not creative. You could also say a human is curious, but I just explained to you a way how one could implement a notion of curiosity into algorithms and where the algorithm is then curious and just explores, in this case, the universe of Super Mario, but you could also put this in a physical universe. And in the end, you could say, okay, a human understands something, a machine doesn't understand. But then the question is, what does it even mean that something understands something? And I think as soon as you write actually down what you actually mean, you could reproduce this algorithmically. So I think the future of this field is extremely interesting, and there will be some wild results soon, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very inspiring talk. So, any questions?
So, I was just wondering, in your predicting of new research kind of crossover, you're basically predicting a new edge in your graph, and which are kind of the most likely to appear in the future. But is there any sort of directionality in that, like you get this new edge, but then no information about how to make this edge a reality.
Yeah,
so have you thought about maybe adding that component?
Yeah, that's a you captured a big problem here, or a problem, a big challenge that the human still needs to interpret what the suggestion means. And probably two humans coming together, or five humans come up with five different interpretations. There are works in, again, computational sociology. And if you have some time, look at the works. Yeah, it's really crazy what those people are doing. So there are some works where they try to build a knowledge network where the edges have much more information, where they use hyper edges and much more information, which could go into this direction. Yeah, but that needs some additional time, yeah.
Maybe just a quick practical question. You have a lot of input data. What's the computational reason?
to train the semantic network took, I don't know, a few days on two GPUs at our cluster,
okay, so it's
nothing
just like
big.
The data from the have like all the
yeah, so the data set what I used here for quantum physics, 750,000 papers, not so large. If you want to expand this, and that would be the cool thing, if you can not only predict inside of quantum physics, but imagine, I don't know, whole physics, then you can talk with your cosmology friend from before. And so that is, of course, much more data where you need to extract. So even the keyword extraction uses those natural language processing tools that need ages probably afterwards. So there it becomes more tricky. Yeah, but at the moment, it's definitely nothing compared to GPT-3 or something.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Actually, I have a question. So for this predicting the trends, obviously, we don't know. I mean, some of the discoveries are these things cannot be any interesting pattern of how new.
So I told you that in the research of AI, where we applied those algorithms, just very recently, there was just a paper 1 or 2 months ago, there we saw quasi-deterministic patterns. So a slightly different question, we saw that we can predict it with 99.8% with the best models, not with my models, but with the best models that those people who won the competition did. And in this competition, there were also some computational sociologists, and we are looking now with those computational sociologists into those quasi-deterministic patterns and try to understand what is predictable. And yeah, it will then probably also lead to a question in general, what is predictable and what seems to be completely random. Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks for a great talk. I just want to see. I may have misunderstood this, but for the computer designed quantum experiments part of the stuff, with the quantum optics stuff, to you know, in your case, you're trying to find the GHZ state, right? In this example, you know, related, I guess, to what you were saying to Anna before, with the bootstraps, the idea of essentially, I don't know, having various experimental options for the experiment or the algorithms already encoded somehow into the computer, right? So is that what you were saying with the bootstrap? And is that what is actually going on here, essentially? You know, and how would that improve, I guess, kind of this whole process?
So imagine you have this toolbox and the algorithm chooses randomly, okay? Right. And this is not changed. But what has changed is the toolbox itself. And first, all the tools are individual optical elements. Like there's one beam splitter that they could choose, there's one laser, there's one crystal, and so on. But later, when it solves some of the sub questions, it puts in maybe already two lasers connected with a beam splitter and a laser. That's actually maybe usually the first thing it actually does, because it sees it can already do something very, very, very useful with that. So this combination of four elements are then also part of the toolbox. So in the next random iteration, there's the possibility to just choose this and already starts with a much more intelligent setup in the first place. And this process continues.
Very cool.
Ben, did you? So this question is also about the quantum optics. But as you're designing these algorithms, sort of choices you'd make about models or cost functions will sort of potentially implicitly bias what solutions you get. And there might be sort of like a trade-off between the amount of computational time to find a solution versus maybe like human knowledge you already have that you inject, whether conscious or not. So how do you think about that as you're designing the algorithms in terms of like balancing how general your algorithm is in order to find solutions sort of a reasonable amount of time?
So we did benchmarks, okay, just about the speed. We did benchmarks with a few other algorithms and saw it is much faster for several cases which allowed comparison. It cannot be efficient up to arbitrary particles because you could build photonic quantum computers, and of course they are not classical computable to the best of our knowledge. So at some point there will be a limit, and we see actually in graph theory, when we translate it, where these limits come from. That comes from the Sharpe complexity to find perfect matchings or to count the perfect matchings. So that's about the speed, but the generality, what you could do, not about the speed, but what you can do in general is, because we have this connection from graphs to quantum experiments, we know that a finite graph could represent setups that have basically infinite many elements, because we know that there is nothing more that those elements can do. everything can already is already captured there. So there, it's basically quite universal. Up to, yeah, there are things we didn't include yet, but everything what we include is then everything you would have in a standard quantum optics lab.
So I think this is probably a basic question, but like, so I'm just trying to understand your link prediction algorithm. So what goes in the input node, input units of your algorithm?
So you mean here?
Yeah, I mean the link prediction algorithm.
Yeah. So in the best case, what you would do is you put in the whole semantic network in, and then it predicts. But that semantic network is 6,000 vertices. You describe it as a 6,000 squared matrix. So that was definitely not possible for me because I'm a lousy programmer. My algorithms are very bad. But what we do is we choose a huge number of unconnected pairs. And from each of those unconnected pairs, we compute a list of, I think, 20 or 30 properties. Properties of the first pair, properties of the second pair. For instance, the degree of it, how many edges it is connected, and so on. Now we know they are not connected, but there could be paths of length 2 that connects those two edges and path of length 3. And we also add some timing information. So these properties in the current year and in the last year and in the last to last year. So those features are the input into the neural network. So roughly 30 features for each unconnected pair. And then the answer is a yes or no.
Okay, I get it then. Thanks.
Last question.
I'll put my laptop away. So I was wondering about like outlier sensitivity with the data sets of, what was it, Physical Review Journal? Like, you got 750,000 papers, but like, in the same way I might want my language model to generate new distributions based on like Shakespeare instead of 4chan posts. How do you control for like small but very important aspects of that data set compared to large, less important ones?
So I'm definitely sensitive to a lot of problems. For instance, not even going into what you said, there are much simpler examples. For instance, when a paper says concept A leads to concept B, or when the paper says we tried concept A and we can prove that it does not lead to concept B, you would not see the difference in my semantic network. But it contains completely opposite information. So one doesn't even need to go to your more fancy examples. There are even much more problems at simpler cases.
But like the model itself, is it sensitive to like very small groups subsets of data?
For the machine learning model, we didn't see that it is sensitive. We trained with different initializations several times, and we basically always get the same score within sub percent.
Mara, just one more question on kind of these sub-questions that you were talking about with the computer design experiments. I'm just trying to think of an example. So for the GHZ state, or to generate, for example, multipartite entanglement, a state with multipartite entanglement, would a sub-question be, for example, well, what about, first generating a bipartite, a state with bipartite entanglement, and then the next time, you know, is storing essentially the solution to that sub-question. Yes. And the next time we do a problem that requires bipartite entanglement, but maybe not producing the same multipartite entanglement state, it can draw on that solution.
Yes.
Is that an example of a sub-question?
Yeah. Not only bipartite, but when you go to higher dimensions, you can also say create a shared set for two dimensions that is already sub-solutions and something like this. And the more subsolution, the more you can break down your questions, the more subsolutions would exist, and the more possibility you have how to put them into your toolbox. You can then also think those subsolutions are probably solved with many different things. Will you put them in multiple times, multiple different ones into the toolbox and so on? So, yeah.
And just a very brief question. Personally, I work more with quantum computing. I've also started learning a bit of graph theory, at least because, as Maddie or you know, many optimization problems get mapped, right? Some graph, but we also think about Hamiltonians in that context, right? So we encode some physical property in a graph together with a Hamiltonian. And I was just curious whether people in this computational sociology field think at all in that way? Like, could you in some sense say that graph dynamics are guided by some Hamiltonian?
Oh, okay.
Is there like some way to describe it? Graph dynamics?
I didn't come across this. It's a cool question. I wonder actually whether a semantic network and neural network prediction would ask such a question. Probably that's one that a machine learning model cannot ask, the connection between quantum and sociology evolution. I don't think they looked into it, but you can break down the question into just a pure math question, and then potentially people looked at, because I know people tried to of course, to run neural networks fast on a quantum computer. So, okay, that goes into a different direction. But actually, so for link prediction task, the question would boil down to, can you do link prediction in a quantum computer faster? And there are some simple algorithms that can do some link prediction. It's called Adami score and so on. And the question would be whether those can be quantized. I have no idea about this. I don't know. But definitely some of those, so there are definitely some network theoretical properties that are very difficult to compute. None of those that I use, because I wanted to compute them, but they are very important properties that would be interesting to compute, for instance, betweenness centrality. So, yeah, that would definitely be a target, could be a target. Yeah, very interesting question. And so Hamiltonian of the whole physical physical community, yeah.
Right, let's thank the speaker again.
Mm-hmm.